I want to welcome you all to the Second Court of Appeals for our second argument of the afternoon. I'll introduce the panel that we have here today. To my left is Justice Brian Walker. To my right is Justice Dabney Basil, and I'm Elizabeth Kerr. I understand counsel have all checked in, and so without further ado, I'll ask the clerk to call the case. Thank you.
Proceed.
Yes.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the court. The issues today are strictly ones of law, reviewed de novo. The underlying judgment is a summary judgment on a contract, a contract that the parties agree is unambiguous. And I emphasize this point because what McCrory did below and what it seeks to do here today is to interject a whole host of disputed facts geared towards smearing my client and smearing basically how we handle this litigation. I will say at the outset that none of that matters given the de novo review. Whether Sushil Patel lied at a deposition, he did not, is irrelevant. That's subject for impeachment and cross-examination. Whether we played discovery games is irrelevant. We did not. The trial court originally sustained a common interest privilege. He later reversed himself. We produced. Still, that is not irrelevant. And there was no discovery abuse. Whether my client, the appellant, the hotel owner, was a serial defaulter is irrelevant. There were a couple historical defaults that were cured and waived. And whether my expert disagreed with a fact witness is, again, a matter for cross-examination. It is not a matter for a ruling on summary judgment as a matter of law at which the trial court cannot gauge the credibility of an expert. So respect.
Question about the devaluation question. That's, if we find there was a default, that question drops out. You don't have a freestanding trade disparagement claim in this case, do you?
That is correct, Your Honor. Yeah. So with that said, Your Honor, there are four issues that I think are the main issues and that I will address. Was there a prepayment by a prohibited person? Did the borrower exercise the parking lot option? Did the trial court properly reject on summary judgment the duty of good faith and fair dealing under New York law? And assuming that I lose all those, did the trial court properly award $1.6 million in attorney's fees to McCrory under what is an indemnification provision? On the prepayment issue, Your Honors, I'm certain Your Honors are familiar with it, but it's very simple. In January 2018, the borrower defaulted to the junior lender, the mezzanine lender. On the eve of foreclosure in March, David McIntyre, the indirect equity owner, paid $28 million to basically retire that debt. It's a question of fact whether it was a settlement of disputed litigation or a prepayment, or rather a payment, but let's assume that it was a payment. The fact that the mezzanine lender had accelerated that debt means that it is not a prepayment as a matter of law.
But what about Section 2.4.3 of the mezzanine loan agreement? If after any event of default, payment or all or any part of the principal of the loan is tendered by borrower, a purchaser at foreclosure, or any other person, such tender shall be deemed an attempt to circumvent the prohibition against prepayment in Section 2.4.
Correct, Your Honor. That is a separate contract executed by separate parties.
Do we not read all this together? I mean, there was an intercreditor agreement, and I mean, should we not be construing the language, same language I realize appears in the senior indebtedness, which is not what we're talking about, but it also appears in the mezzanine loan documents. So why can't we take that all into account?
Because, Your Honor, as we have briefed under New York law, contracts executed contemporaneously by the parties can and should be construed together. However, again, the mezzanine lender is a different lender. The mezzanine borrower is a different borrower. Yes, the contracts are part of the same overall transaction executed on the same date.
But if the mezzanine loan agreement defines what happened here as a prepayment, isn't it a prepayment?
Your Honor, no, because the loan agreement in question here controls. That's a 120-page document with 20 pages of definitions that does not define prepayment. And the loan agreement here does, in one provision, talk about prepaying this loan upon acceleration. That is the principal argument in response to the prepayment. But this different language means different things. Why didn't McCrory use that same language when it talked about this prepayment? In other words, I'm sorry, Your Honor, am I interrupting?
Part of the payment you made to the mezzanine lender, didn't it include prepayment penalties?
It included a compromised amount of not prepayment penalties, but what's called yield maintenance. In other words, the right to future interest. In other words, under New York law, there's a prepayment penalty, which is a penalty. And then there's yield maintenance, which says, well, I anticipated getting X dollars into the future. What the present value of that is Y. And that was compromised at, I want to say, 50%. I was not involved in that. But we can talk about another thing, Your Honor, which is that there are two provisions in this loan agreement governing prepayment. The one general one says no prepayment. The more specific one says no prepayment by the borrower, the guarantor, or the mezz borrower. Again, Mr. McIntyre, who paid the $28 million, was not prohibited from making this prepayment, if it is a prepayment. And, Your Honor, I would again argue that that section is the more specific one. And we noted the more specific section controls. If any prepayment was prohibited, then why would the contract then have to say, oh, wait, a prepayment by the following is prohibited? It would read the more specific one out of the contract. So Justice Basil, my argument primarily is that you don't incorporate contracts by different parties, even if it's related to the same overall transaction. You don't incorporate that. There was no prepayment because this was a payment post-acceleration, and we've cited multiple New York opinions that provide that. And any
in the default provision, in 11.1A23, you are dealing with a disjunctive provision. It says, if any payment or refinancing of the mezzanine loan shall occur without prior consent of the lender, it's an event of default.
That's correct. But how do we reconcile that with a different provision then that says that event of default is any of the foregoing specifically enumerated people make a prepayment? The two are either irreconcilable, or the more specific one must govern. If any prepayment were prohibited, then why would this 120-page document list just the following four people as the ones that can't make the prepayment? Your Honors, let me move briefly to the parking lot option, please. It is not as clear-cut, and I think it's binary. If the court affirms on the prepayment issue, then the parking lot option is irrelevant. If the court reverses on the prepayment issue, then we have a question of fact on first material default, and for that reason alone, the parking lot option ought to be remanded. But I would argue that there was, as a matter of law, no exercise of the parking lot option. What there was there was a timely notice that it would be exercised, and it is true. My client's principal, who's not a lawyer, wrote on there, the parking lot option is hereby exercised. That is true.
Well, didn't that parking lot option agreement say that when notice that it's going to be exercised is given, that creates a binding obligation to follow through?
Yes, it is a binding obligation to follow through, but unless and until various conditions precedent are done, the parking lot option itself has not been exercised, is our primary argument. And our secondary argument, Justice Kerr, I apologize, McCrory, of course, was worried about there being an environmental potential liability. But we have to take into account that option would have expired had we not sent that notice. The hotel would have lost its parking. Would any reasonable lender want that? And we had prepaid all of the money that had been required to pay for the exercise of that option had been paid over the years. So my client literally sent a notice that said, we're going to do this to preserve that parking lot option. And the secondary argument, Your Honor, is that we've cited various provisions that required us to do everything possible to preserve and protect that option, which is defined as a material agreement. So this really is a situation of being between a rock and a hard place. We did seek the lender's consent. We were in the process of working out that consent. McCrory gave us a list of four or five things that would have to happen for that consent to be given. And in the middle of those discussions, they declared a default. Not because there was a legitimate default, Your Honor, but because they wanted to bolster the first default, because by that point in time, I had gotten involved, and I sent them a nasty gram saying, hey, guys, there's no prepayment as a matter of law. So I'll talk more about that on the duty of good faith and fair dealing, but the sending of that notice was required. If we had not sent that notice, we'd be in default. So if nothing else, that is an ambiguity or an irreconcilable catch-22 that merited a trial, that merited the judge deciding which of those two issues takes precedence. But I have found no case that talks about what exactly it means to exercise an option. I would posit that as a matter of logic, and in particular in this instance when we have to send that notice, that the exercise of that option is to actually take title. You're right, there was a binding obligation, but we could have breached that obligation. Maybe there would be a right for specific performance, maybe monetary damages, but I would suggest to the court that as a matter of law, an option to purchase real estate is not exercised until the real estate is purchased.
But still, didn't your agreement require written consent of your senior lender?
It did.
So
to exercise the parking lot option.
Right. And you exercised the option.
I'm arguing, Your Honor.
So you didn't even exercise it.
I'm arguing that we did not.
You just said we intend to.
We intend to. We are starting the process. That is the argument. And again, the agreement doesn't define what exercise an option means. Case law, and I have looked and looked. I could find no case one way or the other. It is an issue, really a first impression. But again, I would argue that I might enter into a contract to buy a particular house, and it's a binding obligation. But unless and until I buy that house, I haven't bought it. So, but I think again, the more interesting question, the one that really merited a fulsome discussion and trial, is how, on the one hand, can the contract prohibit us from sending that notice without consent, while on the other hand, requiring us to send that notice, because if we had not, then a few days later, the option would be gone forever. And again, a multi-hundred unit hotel, a premier hotel in downtown Fort Worth that I helped them purchase out of bankruptcy. I'm a bankruptcy lawyer, by the way, that's why I'm involved in this. I apologize, I love coming to other courts, but I apologize if I'm not as versed in appellate procedure as I could be. But how can that be, that we have to send that notice or a hotel, their collateral, loses parking?
Would they have actually lost the parking? I mean, was the owner of that lot just going to say, you can't park your cars here anymore?
We would have had, in theory, the easement, but an easement is not ownership. It's not fee simple. That easement, who knows what could have happened with that? I don't think it's an easement in perpetuity where we can park cars or we can build additional parking where we can have valet parking. Certainly, again, McCrory, the loan agreement required us to preserve that option, and we did.
Well, and wasn't there some negotiation going on with Texas A&M to switch the lots because theirs is actually closer to the Sheraton?
There was, and that has happened since. My understanding is that has happened since. So, but the point again is that if you're owning a business, if you're owning this hotel, if you have a lender and it's their collateral, you do what you need to do to preserve the parking for that hotel. And that's all that we did. We sent a notice. Your Honors, briefly on the duty of good faith and fair dealing, again, we don't have that in Texas. New York does impose it in every contract. It can be waived by the parties if the language waiving it is unmistakable.
You don't think the words final and conclusive are synonymous with absolute?
No, Your Honor, I don't recall that being in the contract. If I'm wrong on that, I apologize. I recall the contract providing that McCrory's exercise of discretion generally shall be in its sole discretion. But no, if there is language, if there is language like that, then yes, then that would be synonymous with absolute. But as I recall, the provision at question, unlike other provisions that did say sole and absolute discretion, this one provided for sole discretion, which, as I've briefed, just means okay, it's McCrory's discretion, not someone else's. But it doesn't mean absolute. So, if the court finds that that's language waiving duty of good faith and fair dealing, then of course, then I should lose that argument. If the court finds otherwise, then the trial court erred in granting summary judgment because the trial court could not make a finding of credibility on my expert's report. This was not a no evidence MSJ, this was a traditional summary judgment motion where we included the deposition testimony and report of my expert, and the trial court could not disregard that on summary judgment. And finally, Your Honors, on attorney's fees, again, it's shocking that in a 120-page agreement, there is no fee-shifting provision, and that is required by New York law. This is not an issue of Section 38.001. The mezzanine agreement had an attorney fee provision. The intercreditor had an attorney fee provision, but not this loan agreement. That should tell any first-year lawyer who knows how to draft that, if that was the intent of the parties, that should tell the court all it needs to know, that these parties did not intend to have a fee-shifting provision in litigation as amongst themselves. There is what I've labeled, and I believe it's called, an indemnity provision, but as the New York Court of Appeals, the highest court in New York, has said, those are to be narrowly construed, strictly construed, and do not apply to litigation between the parties when the provision is susceptible to third-party claims. That provision itself says that we shall reimburse McCrory for third-party claims. So the argument there is very simple. Because that provision, the only one cited by McCrory as a hypothetical fee-shifting provision, admits the potential of third-party claims. In fact, it spells it out. It is not an attorney fee-shifting provision as a matter of New York law. Your Honors, thank you.
Thank you. Response?
May it please the court. I agree with Mr. Rukavina on one key point. The contracts in this case are unambiguous. I also agree with him that there are four key issues in the case: the prepayment issue, the parking lot option, the bad faith or good faith and fair dealing issue, and attorney's fees. I'll start with section 12.2 of the contract, and I believe we gave each of you a copy of the contract in a binder. Section 12.2, and this goes to the good faith and fair dealing issue. Mr. Rukavina said, if the contract says that McCrory's discretion is final and conclusive, then he should lose that issue. That is exactly what section 12.2 says. It's lender's discretion. Whenever pursuant to this agreement, lender exercises any right given to it to approve or disapprove any arrangement or term is to be satisfactory to lender, the decision of lender to approve or disapprove or to decide whether arrangements or terms are satisfactory or not satisfactory shall, except as otherwise specifically herein provided, be in the sole discretion of the lender and shall be final and conclusive. I think that answers the question on good faith and fair dealing. New York law does not allow the court to change the party's agreement or to deprive a party of the right that it has under the agreement, including a right to exercise its discretion.
Let me interrupt and ask you. You started off by saying that you agree that this agreement is unambiguous. The attorney's fee, the notion that there's a fee-shifting provision, I'm having a hard time kind of squinting at that one to see that that's a clear provision.
Yes.
On fee-shifting between these parties.
So if you turn to page 116 of the agreement in your binder, the section is titled Expenses, Indemnity. Section A is the expenses section. Section B is the indemnity section. And yes, there is a lot loaded into this provision because the lender wanted to make very clear that anything related to this loan, it was entitled to recover its expenses, including its attorney's fees. And the first sentence says, borrower shall pay, or if borrower fails to pay, reimburse lender upon receipt of notice for lender for all reasonable costs and expenses, including attorney's fees and disbursements incurred by the lender in connection with, and then it lists a bunch of categories.
And you're relying on subsection 5.
Subsection 5. And what's important in New York law is what New York law says is if the provision can be interpreted to cover only third-party claims, then that will prohibit you from obtaining attorney's fees. But
Let's look at this provision. I mean, if you strip out all the verbiage in here, it basically says you're defending any action against, under, or affecting the borrower. The article's not in there. Is your lawsuit, or is defending the lawsuit brought by the borrower an action against, under, or affecting borrower?
Yes, and if you go on to read, it also is affecting the loan agreement, affecting the collateral, affecting anything else. So this is clearly both Hooper and the AMBAC case, which are the two main cases defendant cites, say what was missing from those agreements was a clear indication that it covered claims against the defendant in that case. This has language which cannot be read any other way. If you look at Section 5, it first talks about enforcing or preserving rights in response to third-party claims, or, and that disjunctive makes clear that you have to have something more than third-party claims after the or. And that's where it talks about prosecuting or defending of any action or proceeding or otherwise or other litigation or otherwise in each case against, under, or affecting the borrower. And then it also goes on, or affecting any borrower party or the agreement or anything else.
Why is there not a comma after third-party claims, as would seem to be needed if we're shifting gears from responding to third-party claims and suddenly going to defending against something that the borrower is doing?
But it doesn't say in response to defending third-party claims prosecuting. It says in response to defending third-party claims or.
Right.
So you have to have something different than third-party
claims. That's what
after.
I meant. That's why I would expect a comma after third-party
claims.
Yeah,
you could. You certainly could have put a comma in there, and that would have made it a little easier. But there's no other way to read this. I've read it 100 times. And when you go from third-party claims to an or something else, and that or clearly refers to claims against the borrower, prosecuting or defending, that clearly accepts it from the line of cases in New York where you didn't have language talking about claims against the borrower.
Wouldn't it have been a lot clearer if it had spelled out, you know, if the parties to this agreement get into a fight, whoever wins, or no matter who wins, the lender who holds all the cards gets its attorney's fees?
Well, I think that's what this whole paragraph is the lender getting all its expenses for anything involved in the loan. And I think there's always, when you have a dispute, there's ways to make it clearer. But I think this is unambiguous because of the separation of third-party claims from claims prosecuting or defending an action or proceeding against the borrower. So the other two issues are the parking lot option and the prepayment. The prepayment, the language in the agreement is clear. It says in section 11.123, any prepayment or refinancing of the mezzanine loan is an event of default under the agreement. It then says, or a violation of section 4.2.21, that's the section that is limited to certain parties. But it's very clear there's an or there. The parking lot, and then there's two other arguments they make in relation to the prepayment. One is they say, well, this is a prepayment cannot mean a payment after acceleration. Justice Bassel caught that right on. Section 2.3.3 of the mezzanine loan agreement expressly tells you that it is such prepayment if you have a prepayment after acceleration and default. 1701 Commerce argued, yeah, but that language is not in the loan agreement. That's not true. The loan agreement has a nearly identical section 2.3.3, which also refers to a payment after acceleration and after a default as such prepayment. So if it's any kind of prepayment, it's going to be covered by section 11.1, which covers any prepayment.
So let me ask you, and this sort of complicated financing stuff is not my bailiwick exactly, but as I understand it, the reason that a senior lender doesn't want the mezzanine paid off early or first is because you're taking a smaller interest rate and you expect to be paid first. But if somebody comes in, not the borrower, and takes out the mezzanine loan, how does that hurt you?
Well, there's several ways. First of all, you don't know who that borrower is. You don't know what their interest is. Nobody's going to give somebody $28 million for nothing. So then it can affect the ownership structure of the borrower, which is a specific change in ownership is a violation of the loan agreement as well. You can't borrow money from somebody else without violating the loan agreement. So you have to have a lot of information as far as who this person is. And you typically, if somebody comes in and becomes the major owner, they also are required to sign a guarantee. So the president, for instance, has a guarantee. So when you're a major bank, you also don't just, nobody calls you up on the phone and says, I'm going to do a $28 million transaction. Can you approve it? That guy on the end of the phone or the end of the email doesn't have the ability. There's credit. There's risk analysis. There's the senior people at the bank. That they need a formal request which says, here's exactly what we're going to do. Here's our structure. Here's who's going to be the new owners. And then you go back to them and say, okay, I want A, B, C, D, E. I want a guarantee. I want whatever else.
And that was what was raised in the February 13th.
Exactly. They raised the issue a month and a half earlier. Then they went silent, and then they paid off the loan without anybody's permission.
Because there's kind of a sub-issue here, which they raise, which is that there's a fact issue with respect to consent. So I had a couple of questions about, was there ever any, what does the record reflect the response was to the February 13th, 2018 email?
They never provided a formal request. The simple answer to your question is, the contract very clearly provides that what is required is prior written consent. In the trial court, they made a number of arguments as to why they thought oral consent would be satisfactory. They argued modification of the agreement. They argued some other things. They did not argue any of that on appeal. So you have to have a prior written consent. The only document they ever pointed to as the, quote, prior written consent was the February 13 email where Macquarie specifically declined to give consent because they didn't have a formal request or sufficient information. So there is no prior written consent. You don't have to go into any factual issues because the contract makes clear that you have to have that prior written consent. And that's for the same reasons. This is a regulated entity. I mean, these are financial entities. They don't just get to act willy-nilly. If there's going to be a consent, a waiver, anything else, that has to go up the chain at the bank and back down. That's also true for the parking lot option. The only prior written consent they pointed to actually was 4 months after the breach in August of 2018. And it actually didn't give consent. It said you need to do at least these things, and we also need our lawyers to review and sign off on whatever it is you're doing. So there is not a single prior written consent for either of these breaches of the agreement. If I may touch briefly on the parking lot option. So the loan agreement says very clearly, and this is important, we probably ought to take a quick look at it. Their argument basically is I had to exercise the parking lot option or I was going to violate the loan agreement. That is directly contrary to section 4.2.17.
What page?
It's on page 26. This parking lot was a major concern of Macquarie's, this option. They did not want it exercised without clearing the environmental issues. It had been a gas station, so you can actually incur a bunch of, you know, liability for environmental issues. So they wrote into the agreement, notwithstanding anything in this agreement, or any other loan document. So there's a whole bunch of loan documents that are all executed together, including without limitation 4.1.13 hereof, borrowers shall not and shall not cause or permit any of its affiliates to exercise the option. So they made very clear that if there's a conflict between one provision and the other, this provision controls. You cannot go rely on some general provision that says you need to comply with your obligations or whatever. This provision controls. And it says you cannot exercise the option as defined in the parking lot option agreement. We also gave you a binder of our brief with the appendix. If you turn to E is the actual option to purchase agreement. This is the agreement that defines how you exercise the option. And if you turn to the second page of the agreement, there's a provision that says exercise of option. And that provision tells you what it means to exercise the option. It says the option may be exercised by optionee, if at all, at any time during the option term, by delivering a written notice. So that's how you do it. You deliver the written notice signed by the optionee to the owners, stating the optionee's election to purchase the property. And that notice is how you exercise the option, and it's called an option exercise notice. If you turn to tab F, that is the option exercise notice that 1701 Commerce sent. It was signed by 1701 Commerce's president, and it specifically says, this letter and notice serves as the option exercise notice. As that term is defined in the option, pursuant to the option. By delivery of the option exercise notice, optioneer hereby unequivocally and unconditionally states its election to purchase the property pursuant to the terms and conditions of the option. Accordingly, the option is hereby exercised. They now take the position that that didn't exercise the option. Of course, if it didn't exercise the option, then they wouldn't have been able to buy the parking lot because they hadn't exercised the option. So there's a little bit of a tension between the position they were taking with the parking lot owners and the position that they're now taking with Macquarie. They actually told the parking lot owners they were in default because 1701 Commerce said they'd exercised the option and the transaction hadn't closed within the 20-day period. It ultimately did close after the Macquarie loan was paid off. But there is no question, if you look at the option agreement and what it says it means to exercise the option and the letter that they wrote, which was signed by their president, that 1701 Commerce exercised the option. So I think the other kind of main issue that I'd like to touch on just briefly is the prepayment. They have this argument that they say the prepayment really wasn't a payoff of the loan. They didn't pay the mezzanine loan. They just had some settlement that terminated the loan. And so if you look again at our tab, I believe it is tab D of the appendix to appellee's brief, this is actually the payoff letter. This is what they did with the mezzanine lender without running this by Macquarie. And you will see that it doesn't talk about a settlement, doesn't talk about a termination of a loan. It talks about a discounted payoff of the mezzanine loan. The mezzanine loan was $21 million. They paid over $7 million in prepayment and other penalties. Mr. Rukavina said they didn't pay any prepayment penalties. That's not true. They communicated with Torchlight. They negotiated down the prepayment penalties. That's true. But the loan was a $21 million loan, and they paid almost over $7 million in penalties and other fees. I'll also mention one more thing, and this is not directly from the contract, and this is not probably particularly relevant to the contractual, unambiguous language. But 1701 Commerce's president, after they had breached the loan agreement, after they were in default, sent an email to David McIntyre, who was the owner of this indirect minority owner who ended up coming in and paying off these loans. And what he told Mr. McIntyre, and this is in the record at volume 7, clerk's record 3259, he said, if we do this, it will be a default under the loan agreement. And he's talking this point about closing the transaction, the parking lot transaction. He also says, but we're going to do it without telling Macquarie because we don't know how they react, and we're already in default under the loan agreement. He expressly acknowledged his default to a third party, and he told that third party that we're going to default again. I think it's important for the court to understand that in the context of what we're arguing here, although I will admit that it's not particularly relevant to the language of the agreement. I think it is important to understand how this case went down. If there are no more questions, thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you.
Your Honors, Justice Basil Mr. Merrill took you through the sole discretion issue, and he pointed out that that provision, the general provision, says unless this contract elsewhere provides otherwise. If Your Honor would look at page 76, it's section 4.2.17. That's the one that talks about the parking lot option on page 76. That does have other language, as I mentioned to you, Justice Bassel, during my opening. It talks about sole discretion. It does not have any other language, and then it lists some 10 factors that the lender will use in assessing, or rather assessing, whether to give its consent. So with due respect to Mr. Merrill's argument, this is the more specific provision, and his provision expressly says, unless a different provision of this contract provides otherwise.
There's no corresponding provision with respect to the prepayment.
There is not. There is not. On the prepayment issue, Your Honor talked about reading the mezz debt. If we look at page 125, it's section 12.23. It says, this agreement and the other loan documents contain the entire agreement of the parties, et cetera, et cetera. All prior agreements, et cetera, are superseded. It's your standard provision, although with New York lawyers using fancier language than we would. And loan documents,
they get paid
a lot more than I do. And loan documents is expressly defined such that it does not include the mezzanine loan documents. There's some 12 loan documents that are defined. It's in the definitions. It does not include that. So again, if we're looking at what's the intent of the parties, it is that this is our contract, not these other contracts between the other parties. And also, section 12.20 bears merit. And we don't have to go through it, but I'll just reference it. It says that if there's any conflict between anything, disagreement controls, another standard provision. So again, with these sophisticated parties spending $6,000 in lawyer fees to draft a 129-page single-spaced agreement, they didn't define prepayment. They didn't include an attorney fee shifting provision. I think one can read very clearly that therefore they did not intend for those things to be defined the way that McCrory now wants it to be defined. And on the indemnification provision, Justice Kerr, I think that you're questioning was correct, because the language of the highest court of New York couldn't be clearer. It says that the provision must be, quote unquote, unmistakably clear. It says that the obligation must be, quote unquote, strictly construed to avoid reading into it, end quote, a fee-shifting provision. And Mr. Merrill was wrong when he argued that it can be a fee-shifting provision if it can admit or be susceptible to third-party claims. No. As Hooper says, if it is susceptible to third-party claims, if it is susceptible to third-party claims, then it does not apply to attorney's fees between the parties. Quote, unquote, it must exclusively or unequivocally refer to claims between the parties themselves. Then it can be a fee-shifting provision. So again, it's unusual for us Texas lawyers because we're used to attorney fees being awarded under breach of contract claims. New York, as the common law did, has a very strong policy against that. And therefore, courts applying New York law must strictly construe that provision. And unless it can only apply to claims between the parties, it fails. It fails to be a fee-shifting provision. And as I mentioned before, this provision itself expressly states, as Your Honor read, third-party claims. Now, I think they torture that language to try to interject a two-party claim. It doesn't matter. Because it expressly provides for third-party claims, it is not an attorney fee provision. And on Mr. Merrill's final point about Mr. Sushil's email, a man who had terminal cancer, which he survived, thank God, who was facing a default, writing to his business partner that they are in default. Well, they were in default. Where's the disingenuousness or lie about that? McCrory sent a notice of default, and McCrory was charging them punitive default interest. They were in default. Whether that's a legal default, whether that's a breach of contract, that's why they hire people like me to look into that. So nothing should be read from that email to color anything other than that Mr. Patel was saying the truth to his business partner. That is not a judicial or legal admission of someone who's a businessman and is not a lawyer, and it's irrelevant today. Your Honors, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you all very much.
Thank you all. Gentlemen, your argument has been very helpful. We appreciate you being here this afternoon. And with that, your case is submitted, and you're free to go.
Thank you.
All right. And we'll be in recess till 3:30.